Exodus chapter 4, verses 1 to 23. The seventh talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on November 22, 2015, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 7, Exodus 4, 1 through 23, accompanies this talk. Technical difficulties resulted in reduced sound quality for the first few minutes of this talk.
Just remind you that here is the situation. As we talked about, Moses was an individual who had been born into two cultures. He was born the parents that were Levites, Israelites, but he was adopted by the daughter of the Pharaoh and raised in Pharaoh's court. And as a result, he is torn between those two cultures and really doesn't have a place, a home between those two. But he grew up in a privileged situation thinking that he had a calling, and his calling was to help his people get out of Egypt. And we saw in the text that at the age of 40, he took action to help alleviate the suffering of his fellow Israelites. And he killed an Egyptian taskmaster that was being cruel to some Israelites. He did that clandestinely and thought that he had done it without witnesses. But the next day, he stumbled upon a quarrel between two Israelites, and the Israelite that was in fault objected to Moses' intervention and asked him, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us?" And then said, "Are you going to kill me like you'll the Egyptian?" So that was doubly stinging for Moses, because he had been rejected by his own people, and then he realized that what he had done was known. So he fled to the east, went to Midian, where he ended up joining a Midianite family, married one of the daughters of a Midianite priest, and became a shepherd watching the flocks of his father-in-law. One day, while in the desert, he observed a bush that was burning. The fire did not consume the bush, and extremely curious, he went over to see it. A voice spoke out of the bush saying, "Moses, Moses, don't come any closer. Take your shoes off. This is holy ground." And God spoke to Moses and told him that he had seen the affliction of the Israelites and that he was going to bring them out of Egypt. He was going to respond. And then he informed Moses that Moses was the one who was going to actually lead them out. And Moses listed the first of two concerns. It's going to be, end up being four concerns that he voices. The first one is, he says, "Who am I?" Suggesting that he's not the right person for the job. And God's response to that is, "I will be with you." Then he registers another concern. So he said, "What is your name?" God's response to that was to say, "I am who I am." And I take that to mean that the question that was asked is, what is the realm in which you are the force to be reckoned with? Because in a polytheistic worldview, the assumption is that gods have their particular realm in which they are competent. It's like superheroes. You run fast, or you fly, or spin webs, or whatever. That each superhero has his own forte. Well, the gods of the pantheon have their own forte. And the question I think that's being asked is, what is your power? What am I to tell them that your power is? And his response response to that is, I am the God of existence. I don't rule over little realms of the world. I rule over it all. And then God says to him, go to Pharaoh and ask permission for your people to leave, to worship me. He's not going to let me go, but I will use works of power to force him to do so. And as you leave, you will ask the Egyptians for wealth. And we'll
you will not leave penniless. You will leave with wealth. That's where we left off last week. So the interaction continues now into chapter 4. Verse 1, then Moses answered and said, what if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, the Lord has not appeared to you. And the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, a staff. Then he said, throw it on the ground. So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from it. But the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail. So he stretched out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. And the Lord furthermore said to him, now put your hand into your bosom. So he put his hand into his bosom. And when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then he said, put your hand into your bosom again. So he put his hand into his bosom again. And when he took it out of his bosom, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. And it shall come about that if they will not believe you or heed the witness of the first sign, they may believe the witness of their last sign. But it shall be that if they will not believe even those two signs or heed what you say, then you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water which you take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. So now it says, then Moses answered and said, this suggests that he is moving to a new topic. There's a significant break in the text. But it's just a continuation of this interaction that Moses is having with God, in which Moses is listing his concerns to God. His concern this time is, they aren't going to believe me. I'm going to go to him and say, God appeared to me in the desert, and he sent me to get you and bring you out of Egypt. And they're going to say, yeah, right. They're not going to believe that what I'm saying is true. So what am I to do? And God's response to that is not, it doesn't really give an explanation. He doesn't say, give a defense, but he just begins to present to Moses three signs that Moses is supposed to give when he meets with the Israelites. The first one has to do with his staff. And the Lord says to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, a staff. There's a play on words going on here, and there are a lot of plays on words in this text. When he says, what is that in your hand? That in Hebrew is mazeh, and the answer, a staff, is mater. So it's almost the same sounding. So the Lord says mazeh, and he says mater. So I got a staff in my hand, and God says, what I want you to do with that staff is I want you to throw it down on the ground. So Moses throws it down on the ground. And as soon as it hits the ground, it turns into a serpent. It is clearly a serpent. At least it is a serpent such that Moses flees in fear. And this is someone who spent 40 years in the desert. He should know a serpent. We don't know what kind of serpent. We don't know whether it's poisonous. None of that is clear from the text. But Moses probably knows enough to stay away from serpents. So Moses, he flees from this living thing that's now on the ground. But God says to him, I want you to stretch your hand out and take that serpent by the tail. Obviously not good snake handling technique. That's the wrong end. But Moses is apparently trusting what God says. He takes this living snake that's slithering in the dirt, takes it by the tail, and it reverts to being a staff. So that is the first sign that God has given to Moses that he is supposed to replicate when he is meeting with the people of Israel. The second sign, then, is he is supposed to take his hand and put it into his cloak, which he does, and then he brings it out of his cloak, and the hand which had been healthy and whole is now covered with leprosy and is white as snow. Then God tells him to put it back in his cloak, which he does, and when he brings it back the second time, it is made whole again. So that's the second sign. Then the third sign is just explained to Moses. He doesn't perform it, but the third sign that he is supposed to give is he is supposed to take water from the Nile, pour it on dry ground, and it will turn to blood. Now, presumably, the reason he is not performing this is because he has no water from the Nile available to him. He's in the Sinai. He's a long ways from the Nile, so he does not perform that. I'm going to go back now just a little bit. I've given you the three signs, but in between the second and the third sign, let me read you again what it says, starting with verse 8. This is interesting. And it shall come about that if they will not believe you or heed the witness of the first sign, they may believe the witness of the last sign. But it shall be that if they will not believe even these two signs or heed what you say, then you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. So then there's a third one. So he interrupts his presentation. He gives the first two signs and he says, if they won't believe the first sign, that's the staff that turns into a serpent, then perhaps they will believe the second one, which is the leprosy. But if they don't even believe that one, then they will perhaps believe the third one, which is the water from the Nile turning into blood. And when it describes each of these, it uses the same term that Moses had used when he said in verse 1, what if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? Literally it is, they will not listen to my voice. When it talks about the signs, it says, perhaps they will believe, they will listen to the voice of the signs. So we've got four voices. We've got Moses' voice saying what God had done and what it said to him in the desert. Then we've got the three signs all attesting to that same thing that God had sent to Moses. So essentially what God is doing is giving the people of Israel four opportunities to respond, which is a very gracious thing for him to do. It's the mercy of God at work. Okay, I want to talk about these signs a little bit. Why these signs? These are all designed to demonstrate that Moses has been sent by God. The first one, if we take these signs in the context in which they're given, the first one is significant in that the magicians in Egypt were able to take a staff and turn it into a snake and then take that snake and turn it back into a staff. And there are commentators, I assume that it is true because so many commentators say it, that such a phenomenon has been witnessed in the Near East even now, that there is a certain kind of snake that when it is, I guess when it's pinched in a certain nerve or something, it becomes stiff. And you can pick it up, it's like a stick. But then if the pressure is released from that nerve or something, then it becomes active again. So apparently the magicians of Egypt were able to do something of that nature, in which it looks like they have a staff, and it looks like they're turning that staff into a living snake, and it looks like they can take that snake then and turn it into a staff again. Okay. So if that's true, I'm assuming that that's the case, then what this first sign is not just a magic trick like the Egyptian magicians do, but it is a genuine transformation of a staff into a serpent and a serpent back into a staff. It is a far more impressive thing than is the trick that's performed by the magicians. And the significance of that is going to be that whatever it is that the Egyptian magicians can do, that the God who has sent Moses is capable of doing far greater works than they. Sarna is talking about the conception of the magician vis-a-vis the conception, what the God of Moses. He says, in Egypt, the magician manipulates the divine. But that's the role of the magician. That's the role of the priests, is to use their arts to get God to do the things that they want God to do. But he points out there's a significant difference between that and the God that Moses represents. In Israel, it is the one God who manipulates man and nature. So it is the God who is sending Moses who has complete control over nature, such that he's the one who changes the staff into the serpent and the serpent into the staff. And it's not a trick. It's something that is actually done. The second one is the transformation, is the leprosy and then doing away with the leprosy. And the significance of that in their time and culture would be that God is demonstrating his power over disease. Leprosy was thought to be an incurable disease, and to have the power to take that which is leprous and cleanse it and take the leprosy away, that is a significant achievement. That is a miraculous achievement. And there's no indication that the magicians could replicate that. And the third, that they believed that the Nile was both a god and the source of life for Egypt. In many ways, it was the source of life for Egypt. So for Moses to take water from the Nile and turn that to blood would be a serious thing insofar as taking the source of life and making it no longer life-giving. So there's a threat that's involved there, indicating that God has control over the Nile as a god and over nature with respect to the Nile, and has the ability to turn that which is a source of life into a source of death. And as we go through the plagues, we will see that it's turning the water of the Nile to blood that's going to start a series of plagues that will result in death to all the firstborn in Egypt. There are a few observations I'd like to make about these three signs. The first is, all of them are changes from something good into something bad. The staff into a serpent, which is fear-evoking. The second, the changing of a whole hand, a healthy hand, into a leprous hand. And the third, taking the water of the Nile and transforming it into blood. The last one, what the blood indicates, what it stands for, is debatable. Some scholars say that the root symbolism involved in the blood is that it's life, but others say it's death, and I think that more captures the reality. And in this case, I think it has to be death that's being indicated by the blood. Interestingly, the first two, after they're changed from good to bad, are then changed back to something good, restored back to that good beginning. And as I pointed out, the first two are demonstrated at this time. The third one is not demonstrated at this time. Moses is going to have to take it on faith that when it comes down to it, God can pull off that third one as well. And it's interesting that God demonstrates those first two, because it seems to me that Moses is in a position in his life where he needs that demonstrated to him. He's the only witness there, so it must be for his sake. And Moses has been shaken in his understanding of who God is, such that he also needs the signs. He needs that help in seeing who God is and what God is capable of doing. So the signs are really first for Moses right here. Later, they're going to be presented to the people of Israel. And then there's a sense in which, thirdly, they are presented to Pharaoh and all of the Egyptians. Okay. Now, this question, do these signs have symbolic significance? I'm going to save that until the conclusion, but I think that's an important question. The next concern that Moses raises is in verse 10, where he is concerned that he's not eloquent enough for the task. Verse 10, Then Moses said to the Lord, "Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past, nor since thou hast spoken to thy servant. For I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." And the Lord said to him, "Who has made man's mouth? Or who makes him dumb, or deaf, or seeing, or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now then go, and I, even I, will be with your mouth, and teach you what you are to say." But he said, "Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever thou wilt." So his concern, this concern, is he's not eloquent. People have debated what is the nature of his lack of eloquence. Some have suggested that he stuttered. I think the phrase is actually slow of speech is literally what's going on here. And so it's possible that it's stuttering, but it could be other things as well. Some have suggested that he's been gone for so long that he has forgotten his Hebrew, possibly. Or he's forgotten his Egyptian, possibly. But I'm dubious. I don't think that it's likely that any of those three are the case. My suspicion is, his concern is that he knows he has to go and talk to a group of people that are going to be very reluctant to accept his claim that he has been sent by God. And they are going to be very reluctant to accept his leadership. And he's thinking, the only chance that one would have, anyone would have, of being a leader with respect to this group of people is if they are extremely persuasive, eloquent and persuasive, and that they can lay out what needs to be done and why it needs to be done and convince everyone to follow along. And he's thinking, I'm not up to that. Interestingly, it says in Acts 7, in Stephen's speech, where he's talking about the history of Israel and explaining all of the rebelliousness that has been exhibited over the decades, he talks a little bit about Moses, and in so doing, he makes this claim with respect to Moses. He says, "And Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds." Suggesting that there isn't a lack of competence with respect to Moses' ability to speak. That's not a problem. He was very competent in speaking. And I'll point out that in the rest of the Pentateuch, we have a number of speeches by Moses, and they are very powerful and good speeches. So I think that he thought that the problem was he wasn't persuasive enough. But the reality is, he was plenty persuasive enough. But I think that he correctly suspects that getting the people of Israel to follow his leadership or anybody's leadership is a very difficult challenge, and one that, in some respects, he's not up to and that no one is up to. God responds to that, and his response is interesting to me because it is not God's approach to say, "No, you're a good speaker. You really are good." He doesn't reassure him of his competence. He takes the approach, that's irrelevant. Your competence is irrelevant. That I am the one who provides the words. I made you. I made your mouth. I made you. I'm the one who provides the words. I'm the competence. You don't need the competence. God is the one who makes this. Who has made man's mouth? Or who makes him dumb or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? So go ahead, I'll teach you what to say. I will provide the competence. Sarna, with respect to this passage, says, "The chosen messenger conveys not his own word, but the word of God. And he does so because he is irresistibly compelled to by a force and a will more powerful than his own. Prophetic eloquence is not a matter of native talent, but of revelation that derives from the supreme source of truth that is external to the speaker. The facile talker, the golden-tongued, the consummate demagogue is not the recipient of the prophetic word or the vehicle of its transmission. Prophetic eloquence is a divine gift bestowed for the purpose on him who is elected, often against his will, to be his messenger. In these circumstances, experience and talent are irrelevant qualities. So that's God's response to this concern. At which point, Moses says just flat out, "Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever thou wilt." In other words, "I don't care what you've said, send somebody else. I'm not the person for the job." At that point, God becomes angry, as we see in verse 14. "Then the anger of the Lord burned against Moses, and he said, 'Is there not your brother Aaron the Levite? I know that he speaks fluently. And moreover, behold, he is coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. And you are to speak to him and put the words in his mouth. And I, even I, will be with your mouth and his mouth, and I will teach you what you are to do. Moreover, he shall speak for you to the people, and it shall come about that he shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be as God to him. And you shall take in your hand this staff, with which you shall perform the signs.'" So God becomes angry, and the anger is brought out because it is clear at this point that the concerns that Moses has been listing are not really concerns as much as they are excuses. Because concerns God can address, and he has an answer for every concern. But what he can't address is flat-out refusal, disobedience. But God is very merciful here. Instead of just condemning Moses, he actually offers some help with respect to this last issue that Moses has raised. He's going to provide his brother Aaron as a spokesman. His brother Aaron speaks very good, so his brother will be the one who will be able to speak for him and take care of that responsibility for him. I find it interesting that as you go through the rest of the Pentateuch, it is very rare that Aaron speaks for Moses. Aaron speaks a few times, but Moses does it the vast majority of times. So technically, Aaron then becomes his spokesperson, but as we see in the Pentateuch, it was not really necessary. At this point, God explains something here that I think is interesting. He seems to be establishing a relationship here. He says, "You will be to Aaron as I am to you." So as God speaks to Moses and Moses passes that on to others, similarly, Moses will speak to Aaron and Aaron will pass that on. So we're setting up a chain whereby the message is passed. It originates with God. It goes to Moses, who I think is representative of the prophets. It goes from the prophets to the priesthood. I think Aaron is representative of that. And then Aaron presents it to the people. So God, the prophets, the priesthood, and the people. That's the chain whereby God's messages are presented. And then in verse 17, and it says, "And you shall take in your hand this staff with which you shall perform the signs." We've seen the staff before, but it is interesting that the staff started out as his shepherd's staff. So it's just a stick that he as a shepherd carried with him and used as an aid. So it is a lowly instrument used by someone of low social standing. And yet now he is to take it with him because it is the staff with which he will be performing the signs. It will be the staff that commands these signs. Okay, at that point, this exchange between God and Moses ends, and Moses is going to leave and begin to enact what God had told him to do. Verse 18, "Then Moses departed and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, 'Please let me go, that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see if they are still alive.' And Jethro said to Moses, 'Go in peace. Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead." So Moses took his wife and his sons and mounted them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt. Moses also took the staff of God in his hand. And the Lord said to Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders which I have put in your power. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my son go, that he may serve me. But you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn.'" So Moses leaves. He returns to Jethro. It's not clear where Jethro is at this time, whether Jethro's in the Sinai or whether Jethro is in Midian. And he asks for permission to go. But what he says is a little surprising. He says, "Please let me go that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see if they are still alive." That may be an interest of Moses's. It may be that he would like to go see how his kinsmen are doing. But we know that's not primarily why he's going to Egypt. I don't know why Moses is hiding the real reason why he's going to Egypt. Maybe it's just not time for that to be known. I'm not sure. But I find it curious that Moses is not more straightforward at this point. Jethro grants his blessing for him to go. So Moses then apparently goes through all the steps of preparing himself to go. And at that time, he receives a message from God saying that now is the time to go because all the men who were seeking your life are dead. Presumably what that means is that the Pharaoh has died. And probably not just the Pharaoh, but the Pharaoh and his advisors are probably all dead at this point. And I don't remember whether I've mentioned this before or not, but when it was customary, when the Pharaoh would die, that the new Pharaoh would proclaim pardons on various individuals. And there was probably hope that Moses could be pardoned at this point, and therefore he could go back. There was probably also the expectation on the part of the Israelites that with a new Pharaoh coming into power, that they may be able to get their situation improved, that the new Pharaoh might have a change in policy with respect to them. So he packs up his wife, and he has two sons at this point, as we learn later, and they head off for the land of Egypt. Now, exactly what happens with his wife and his sons is unclear, because as we'll see later on in Exodus, we know that for part of the time they were with Jethro. So it may be that they just went part way and then turned back. It's not really clear. But at this point in the narrative, they are all headed off for Egypt. Then God says, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders which I have put in your power." I think this is interesting that the emphasis here is that he will perform these signs before Pharaoh. If you look back at the concerns that Moses lists of why he is not the person for the job, none of them are because he's afraid of standing before Pharaoh. As part of his job, he has to go and go before the most powerful man in the world and say some things that the most powerful man in the world is not going to like at all. And yet, that's not his concern. All of his concerns have to do with his acceptance by the people of Israel. That's what scares him. And he seems to be confident that that's not going to happen, or at least fearful that that's not going to happen. But God here is saying, you're going to perform all of these signs and wonders before the Pharaoh, and be sure that you do them. But what I'm going to do is I am going to harden his heart, and he is not going to be swayed by the signs, and it is going to get to the place that in order to force him to allow Israel, and Israel is my firstborn, in order to force him to allow my firstborn to serve me. And as I understand it, a firstborn child was seen to be the servant of the father until the firstborn receives the double blessing and is supposed to serve the father until receiving the double blessing. So God is saying, you have not allowed Israel, my firstborn, to serve me. Therefore, I will put your firstborn to death. I will kill your firstborn. That's the message that he's supposed to deliver to Pharaoh, and that's a message that Pharaoh is not going to want to hear. Okay. It is interesting that if we follow these things that God has said to Moses, he'll say, with respect to what's going to happen when he gets back to Egypt, he says a little bit, and then later he'll repeat some of that and add a little bit of new information. And then again, he'll kind of repeat some of that and add a little bit of new information. But the picture slowly becomes a little bit clearer. But never does God lay it all out before it happens. God is very stingy with that kind of information. And I think that holds true today as well. Okay, I want to talk about the symbolism of the signs, and then I want to talk a little bit about what we see here about Moses and his character. I think that these three signs are symbolic. I think they have to be symbolic. That there's a symbolism that is built into them that goes beyond what I have talked about so far. How would we know that these signs are symbolic? And I've been thinking about that. How would you know that what anyone says or does is symbolic? And I've been thinking about the recent attacks in Paris. It appears that the jihadists like to pick targets that have symbolic value. With the first attack in 9/11, attacking the Twin Towers, clearly that was not picked for strategic reasons. That was picked for symbolic reasons. The attacks in Paris, what places did they attack? It was all places where Westerners have decadent fun. Those are the kinds of places that the jihadists picked out for their symbolic value. And then I learned a couple days after the attacks that the concert hall that they attacked until recently was owned by a Jew, and that many of the events that were held there were known for being Jewish events. Well, that makes it a very powerful symbol. So I'm convinced that the primary consideration for jihadists when they're picking their targets is the symbolism that's involved. It's not a more practical, strategic selection. It's symbolism that they're after. Well, that means now we can look at any attacks they do in the future or even attacks that they've done in the past and try to figure out what is the symbolism behind this particular target. So it's a track record. It's a track record of using symbolism that leads one to believe that symbolism will appear elsewhere in what they say or do. And I would argue that God has a track record of symbolism in the Old Testament. There are all kinds of symbols in the Old Testament. We can talk about the temple is just full of symbolism. The sacrificial system is full of symbolism. Even before that, we have Noah and the flood. And how does that culminate? There is a rainbow in the sky, and it is given significance. It is a symbol. So I'm convinced that we are justified in looking for symbolism, even in these signs. But when we interpret the symbolism that's built into these signs, what happens with authorial intent? Do we look to what the author of Exodus intended when he described these signs? And I would say no. That what we're looking for when we're reading Exodus and we want to figure out what Exodus is saying, then we are looking for the intent of the author of Exodus, we'll say Moses, and in the description of the signs, what he is doing is telling us what happened And we can understand that in the context in which it was given. That is, how would the audience then understand these signs? And when I went through, I tried to give you what I think the audience then would have understood by those signs. That is, that God is more powerful than the gods of Egypt, essentially, with each of them. But those signs fit into a bigger body of work, and that is the book of history that God is writing. So now we have, in this passage, we have God presenting signs, and those signs appear in the book of Exodus, but they're also a part of the book of history. So now it's a question of how do we interpret that book? And I would argue that we interpret that book similar to the way that we would interpret a novel. That is, looking at the whole work, what makes the best sense out of all of the clues? And if we see something symbolic in there, what makes the best sense out of that symbol in the context of the whole work? Okay, interpreting the book of history, that's a big task. That's a hard thing to do. But I think it is something that we ought to be working on and doing as best we can, and understanding the teachings of the biblical text are extremely significant. They are our main guide in interpreting the book of history that God has written. Okay, so if that's true, then what do these signs mean? And looking at commentaries, they offer all kinds of things. There are as many offerings as there are commentators. It is pretty common for commentators to read Jesus into the signs. And there is a sense in which I am resistant to that. Because in my past, what I have heard teachers do when they're dealing with the Old Testament is they'll read the Old Testament passage and then they'll tell you what that's telling us about Jesus. And there are some pretty wild things that have been discovered to be told about Jesus by reading the Old Testament that way. So I am reluctant to go in that direction on the one hand. On the other hand, it is, I think, true that Jesus is kind of the pinnacle of the whole book of history. He is that towards which everything is pointing. So there is a sense in which it is legitimate and true that everything in the Old Testament is pointing to Jesus. My concern is that we start with the Old Testament and give it its due, understand it as it was intended, before we start jumping to reading Jesus into it. And that's an important step that can't be skipped. Having said that, I think these signs are about Jesus, but I'm not sure. This is stuff that I am working on, and I'm trying to understand better how to put these pieces together that we find in the Old Testament. But I think it's very interesting that the first sign that he gives, we start with a staff, a shepherd's staff, throws it on the ground into the dirt. It becomes a serpent, and then he picks it up from the dirt, and it's a staff again. But I think we're seeing a progression here, that it is just a shepherd's staff. It is thrown into the dirt. It becomes a serpent, which is, we've seen in Genesis, it is Satan. It is the epitome of evil. And then it is brought out of the dirt, and it becomes a staff again. My suspicion is that we're looking at the death of Jesus and the resurrection, that a lowly, insignificant person on the one hand, who is made to be sin on our behalf and then is raised up to a position of authority. And therefore, the sign that's being talked about here, I think, is the death and resurrection of Jesus. The second one, the sign of leprosy, becomes one of the forms by which something is made unclean as the law is presented. And I'm suspicious here that we're looking at that which is unclean being made clean. So if that's what's happening, then the second witness, the second sign, is that which is unclean being made clean. And I think that is the witness of those who have been transformed by God's grace. And the third sign, taking that which is the source of life and turning it into death, the third sign is the futility, death, and destruction that's built into our existence. That apart from God, that's all there is. And my suspicion is that that's the significance of the third sign, is that apart from God, death is all there is. Okay. Now, that may not be right, but it's an attempt, and it's something to think about. The other thing I want to talk about, and I've touched on this some, but I have personally found this fascinating, because in the past, I have looked at Moses as being kind of like Jesus, almost sinless. He just did one sin, so he didn't get to go into the promised land, but otherwise he was sinless. And as I've been reading through this and thinking about it, I've really changed my perspective on that. And I want to be cautious here because I don't want to turn him into an anti-hero. Moses is very admirable. There's no question about it. He's exemplary in many, many respects. But what's clear to me is he's struggling as a human being more than I had ever seen before. If we think about the flaws that have shown up here, he's been beat up by life. He's been scarred. As a result, he's got his insecurities. He's lost his self-confidence. He's lost his sense of purpose that he had at the age of 40. All of these he had at the age of 40, and he's lost them all. He was alienated from his people, and we'll talk about that more next week because I think that's significant for understanding the next passage. And it seems to me his faith in God has been shaken as well. And this is all at the age of 80. So God has taken him through on this path where he kind of developed a direction in life, a purpose, an understanding of what God was doing, and it all caved in at the age of 40. He goes out in the desert, and for 40 years, he's confused and has lost all of that that he had had. I can identify with that, and I think it's very interesting. I'm not 80 yet, but I can identify with that. So when God appears to him, he doesn't want to go. I think he genuinely does not want to do it. He's lost all of his confidence. He doesn't feel connection with his people anymore, etc., etc. And yet, his time in the desert was preparation for the very thing that God is asking him to do. It's just other preparation. And God does a lot of other preparation. And what I mean by other preparation is it's not the kind of preparation that you would expect for the task at hand. I would say that David is a great example of other preparation, David and Goliath. That what you would expect in preparation for Goliath is training in hand-to-hand combat and using the weapons of war and armor and all that sort of thing. But David didn't have any of that. David had other preparation, which prepared him better for the task than standard preparation would have done. So Moses was for 40 years getting other preparation. And God is in a position, as the author of history, of seeing in advance 400 years and more what's coming up and making the adjustments that he wants to make and preparing people the way that he wants to prepare them to do the things that he wants them to do. There are no circumstances that sneak up on God, and he makes preparations for those things long in advance. As a result, the training he was getting in the desert was perfect for the task, but it would not have been possible for Moses to have seen that when it was happening. And the wrestling that he did with his problems while he was in the desert was all important with respect to the task that's being assigned. And that means that as we go through and see God presenting himself to Israel, there's a sense in which God is presenting himself to Moses as well. Moses is learning these things in a way that he has not learned them right along. And that's why I think it's important to note that those signs were given to Moses in the desert where nobody else was. God was teaching Moses in that instance. So I take great solace in reading about Moses. I find it very interesting and encouraging. Okay, I told you I'd save time for questions. I didn't. Are there burning questions? Let me take one question back there just so I can say I took questions.
But just a clarification, when you talked about the play on words of the staff,
yeah,
you indicated that there was a difference in sound and
yes,
in Hebrew words, but you didn't indicate the difference in meaning. So is there a difference in meaning?
Mazeh means what's that?
Oh, okay.
And mateh means staff. Oh, so God says to him, mazeh, and he says back, mateh. So it's, I don't think that there is anything of interpretive significance, exegetical significance there. It's just an interesting literary device where there's a play on words, and that helps understand why the wording is what it is, that there was the intent to make it, I guess, artistic. And that happens quite often in these texts. Sometimes it's more than just artistic. Sometimes it is actually showing you connections and showing you where the text needs to be divided up into paragraphs. In this case, I don't, maybe there is exegetical significance, but it's lost on me. But it is an interesting literary thing.
Thank you.
Okay, so next week, time for questions.